If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Late Night with Seth Meyers podcast. I'm Sarah Jenks Daly, a producer here at the show. In today's episode, we were lucky enough to get Malcolm Jenkins right after his Super Bowl win with the Philadelphia Eagles. I hope you will stick around because after Seth's interview with him, I got to talk to Malcolm backstage about some issues he's truly passionate about, including the Players Coalition and his own foundation. After Malcolm, you'll hear Seth's interview with Glenn Howerton, the star of the hilarious new sitcom AP Bio, which Seth also happens to be a producer of. And afterwards, my friend, late night producer Kevin Miller, talks to him backstage just for the podcast. First, though, let's hear Seth take a closer look at the news.
President Trump is crowing about the release of a disputed and misleading memo written by House Republicans that he claims vindicates him in the Russia probe. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. We all know Donald Trump has a well-documented history of overreaching and bragging about things that quickly turn out to be either exaggerated or outright fabrications. He just can't help himself. If he fell down a flight of stairs, he would brag that he found the fastest way down. And even before the memo's release last week, we got yet another example of that when remarks surfaced from a private meeting Trump had with Republicans at his D.C. hotel on Thursday, where he bragged about his score on a screening test for dementia. Trump complained that the media was not giving him credit for what he claimed are the more difficult parts of the test. Let me tell you, those last 10 questions are hard. They don't show those 10 questions. You look at the first questions. What is this? Lion. What is this? Elephant. And what is this? That is a cow. They show you the first one where you have to say elephant, lion, giraffe, owl. It's easy. Dude, it's a screening test for dementia, not the SATs. You didn't test into Harvard. You tested out of hospice care. Also, there's a possibility Trump wasn't even taking the test and just sees everyone he talks to as an animal, like he's in an episode of Looney Tunes. Turtle, giraffe, albino hedgehog. But while he brags... while he brags about his score on a screening test, Trump is also bragging that the release of a disputed and deeply misleading memo written by House Republicans exonerates him in the Russia probe. The memo was called inaccurate by his own hand-picked FBI director, and yet, after the memo was released, Trump lashed out at his critics in the Oval Office, although his take on the memo itself was super vague.
I think it's terrible. You want to know the truth? I think it's a disgrace. What's going on in this country, I think it's a disgrace. The memo was sent to Congress. It was declassified. Congress will do whatever they're going to do. But I think it's a disgrace what's happening in our country. And when you look at that, and you see that and so many other things, what's going on. A lot of people should be ashamed of themselves and much worse than that. So I sent it over to Congress. They will do what they're going to do. Whatever they do is fine. It was declassified. And let's see what happens.
Do that things. Based on the way Trump talks about the memo, one thing is clear. He definitely didn't read the memo. In fact, nothing makes clearer that this whole thing was a partisan exercise aimed at misleading the public and discrediting the Russia investigation than the fact that Trump and his allies immediately began celebrating as soon as the memo was released. Just take his son, Don Jr., seen here on his way to shut down an orphanage to make room for a hair gel museum. Now, let's remember, Don Jr. met secretly with Russian operatives offering dirt on Hillary Clinton during the campaign at Trump Tower with Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort, a meeting that was literally billed to him as, quote, part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump. And yet, Don Jr. went on Fox News to claim that the GOP memo disproved the entire Russia investigation.
What does this say now about the entire investigation? Is it rotten to the core?
Listen, it always has been.
You're right.
We always said this. I mean, it is so ridiculous that let it go, though. At this point, let it go. At least they uncovered this, because what if they wouldn't have? What if they would have just let it go? At this point, I mean, there is a little bit of sweet revenge in it for me and certainly probably the family.
Sweet revenge for the family? That sounds like something you say to a guy just before you close the car trunk on him. Say hello to the worms from the trunk family. So what does this memo written entirely by House Republicans actually say? Well, to understand the memo, you first need to understand the man behind it, California Congressman Devin Nunes, who, of course, has been compromised by the Russians ever since Putin got a hold of his high school yearbook photo. That's the actual photo. Looking at the photo, Mr. Nunes, there is business in front and party in back. You know this photo? Now, in this memo, Nunes is claiming the government abused its surveillance powers as part of a conspiracy to target a political adversary, which might make you ask, what's his background? Is it an espionage, counterintelligence, constitutional law? Well, as the Daily Beast reported, the man charged with oversight of our nation's spies is a dairy farmer with 3 degrees in agriculture. Nunes believes his agriculture background informs his work on intelligence due to his familiarity with various farming techniques that have overlapped with intelligence. So Nunes and Trump have at least one thing in common. Their main qualification is that they can both identify a cow. But hey, we have a civilian government, and anyone has the right to question our leaders. You don't have to be an expert. The problem with Nunes is that he's always seemed more interested in helping Trump than investigating him. As you might recall, Nunes was originally in charge of the Russia investigation in the House before he was forced to step aside after some bizarre behavior.
It was Tuesday night here in Washington, D.C., when Chairman Nunes was riding in a car with a staff member. That's when he got some type of message on his phone and abruptly got out of that car and into an Uber. He then seemingly disappeared into the night.
Oh, my God. Devin Nunes is not 007. He's just a double zero. Real spies don't take Uber. It's way too easy to get caught. You can't prove I was in that car. Yeah, we can. Your driver gave you 1 star. He said you kept telling him to call you Nunes. Devin Nunes. Now, Nunes's 4-page memo is about a warrant to surveil a Trump campaign foreign policy advisor named Carter Page under what's known as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. FISA warrants are generally very dense, detailed documents, 50, 60 pages long, and they have to be signed off on by multiple law enforcement officials and approved by a FISA court. So if Nunes were going to write an explosive memo accusing the FBI of abusing that authority, you'd think he would have at least read the actual FISA application, right?
Did you read the actual FISA applications?
No, I didn't.
Oh, my God, these two. Mr. President, I summarized a 60-page document into 4 pages for you. Did you read it? I didn't. Well, I'm not going to read this. Sounds good. What should we do now? Let's identify some cows. That's one. So what's in the warrant application that Nunes objects to? He claims that in its application for the warrant, the FBI used information from that infamous dossier you've probably heard about, the one that was put together by ex-British spy Christopher Steele. Trump's allies in Congress and on Fox News has obsessively harped on the unverified parts to try and discredit the entire dossier, as we found yet again on Sean Hannity's show on Thursday.
Let's say Donald Trump produces a memo that says Hillary Clinton had hookers in her room in a Ritz hotel in Moscow urinating on her bed. Now, if that was in there and it was not true, and then it ends up being the basis in part for a FISA warrant against her used by Trump, you'd be pretty pissed off.
Absolutely.
And the media would be apoplectic tonight, true or false.
Absolutely.
True.
By the way, this is the only show that I've ever been able to talk about the pee tape on. So that makes me
and
really
And you know
happy.
It's not true.
You know it's not true.
If someone pees in the bed, where are you going to sleep?
Well, I don't think
where
he
are you sleep?
I don't think he's having a sleepover.
It's obviously
with them.
Not true. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense because we all know that Donald Trump always thinks things through. I could definitely see Trump going through all of the trouble of booking a specific room in a specific hotel, hiring a bunch of hookers to pee on the bed, paying them to stay quiet, and then realizing he didn't think about where he was going to sleep. Okay, good show. I'm going to call it a night. Oh, no. No. Now, the Nunes memo makes two central claims that are already being refuted. One, that the FBI did not reveal the political origins of the dossier to the court when it applied for the warrant. And two, that FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe testified that without the dossier, the FBI would not have applied for the warrant to begin with. In fact, not only does the Nunes memo fail to provide any actual evidence to impugn the Russia investigation, it actually confirms a key detail, the fact that the investigation began not with Page or the dossier, but with George Papadopoulos, the Trump campaign foreign policy advisor who has since pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russians. And yet today, Nunes went on Fox and Friends to downplay that finding, which came from his own memo.
Some say, well, what about Papadopoulos? They started looking at him earlier. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say that if Papadopoulos was such a major figure, why didn't you get a warrant on him? Yeah. If Papadopoulos was such a major figure, you had nothing on him. You know, the guy lied. As far as we can tell, Papadopoulos never even knew who Trump was, or, you know, never even had met with the president.
Yeah, as far as we know, Trump never met Papadopoulos, except there's an actual photo of the two of them at a meeting together, and it's been around for months. Are you really the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, or did they just give you that title as a joke and it just stuck? You know, like when you get a turtle and name him Speedy. So what has Nunes gotten in return for carrying Trump's water and staking his career and reputation on the outcome of the Russia investigation? He got what everyone who helps Trump gets, a tweet.
The president tweeted today praising Devin Nunes, a Republican on the House Intelligence Committee, saying, Representative Devin Nunes, a man of tremendous courage and grit, may someday be recognized as a great American hero for what he has exposed and what he has had to endure.
I'm sorry, but Devin Nunes will not be remembered as a hero. Nunes isn't Sully. He's one of the birds that got sucked into the engine. One of the shames of this whole episode is that there are very real abuses of power in our law enforcement agencies, and it would be great if Congress would exercise actual oversight over those. Instead, Nunes and his colleagues just voted last month to renew the most controversial part of FISA, the part that allows the government to spy on American communications without a warrant. There are important questions to ask about how the government uses its surveillance power. Instead, Republicans are asking questions like this.
If someone pees in the bed, where are you going to sleep?
This has been A Closer Look. Our guest is the captain of the Philadelphia Eagles, a two-time Pro Bowler, and as of Sunday, a two-time Super Bowl champion. Please welcome to the show, Malcolm Jenkins, everyone.
Appreciate you having me.
Congratulations. You are dressed like a champion, may I say.
Oh, yeah, you know.
Very dapper.
I make suits for a living. People don't know that about me.
This is a suit you made?
I made this. Damaris Seville is my company. We got a brick and mortar in Philadelphia.
This is very upsetting to me that you're good at another thing. I don't like that. So this was the second time that you were a Super Bowl champion. You won with the New Orleans Saints your rookie year, which was, of course, their first Super Bowl ever as well. And what was it like being a veteran compared to the experience?
Well, that first one in 2009, I was a rookie, and my head was spinning. You know, we're getting ready to play the Colts, Peyton Manning, and the great, you know, offense they had. And I wasn't supposed to start. I was a special teams guy, and the starter in front of me got walking pneumonia like 2 days before the game. And I got thrown in kind of the second half. And so everything happened so fast, I didn't even get to enjoy it. But this time around, being a veteran, being a captain of the team, being a key contributor, and everything that led up to this year, it was something different. Be able to bring that to the city of Philadelphia is something that myself and my family won't forget.
Fantastic. A couple photos. There you are. Far too well-dressed. But I have to say, as when it comes to well-dressed in the family, this is your daughter. Is it Elle?
Elle.
Yeah. So how old is Elle? She was at the game.
Elle just turned 4. Yes.
Fantastic.
She had her eagle wings on.
That's very good.
But, you know, she, in the playoffs, she was like, hey, daddy's going to the supermarket. But but by the time we got to Super Bowl Sunday, she understood everything that was going on.
That's
like,
great.
You just won the Super Bowl.
Oh, that's very exciting. And I guess that would be a nice difference between your rookie year and now, too, is that you had someone who, like, you had kids to share it with.
I have 2 kids now, yeah. Just had a daughter 3 weeks ago, Salah.
Congratulations. So, now... my dad's from Pittsburgh, so I grew up a Steelers fan, and I was very happy because now the Steelers, at least for another year, still have the most Super Bowl trophies.
There you go.
Your dad was a Giants fan and held on to being a Giants fan for a long time, right?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in northern New Jersey, so that's Giants, you know, country.
Yeah.
But he was looking for a reason to give up on Eli Manning and those guys, so... when I got to New Orleans, he obviously became a Saints fan. I came up to Philly, and there was no way he had to cut every tie that he had to that team. He did it willingly. And, you know, after those Super Bowl commercials, I think he's probably thinking that was a great decision.
So I want to commend you because you are very involved with the community and on a larger scale, how the NFL players are trying to approach sort of this very charged year as far as the politics of the NFL and players reaching out to their communities. Tell us about the Players Coalition that you're one of the members of.
Yeah, so in 2016, I think after the killings of Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, the officers in Dallas, I think there were a ton of players that kind of had that light bulb moment where they wanted to get involved and get from behind our, you know, Twitter tags and social media and really become part of the process. And guys started talking to police. They started talking to legislators. You saw Colin Kaepernick start the NFL protest that everybody's, you know, been talking about for the last 2 years. And at the start of 2017, myself, Anquan Boldin, and about three other players took our second trip to Capitol Hill to speak to legislators about criminal justice reform and how we could really lend our platform and voices to push for the legislative changes that we wanted to see. And once we saw that we were able to get 3 days of meetings, meet with Republicans, Democrats, and have all of this influence, we said it would be something if we could get together as athletes all across this league and really amplify our voices. And we started what we call the Players Coalition. And we were able to engage, thank you, able to engage guys on almost every NFL team. And we've able been able to pass that baton and engage with the NFL to see or to work with them on how to amplify our words, our thoughts, to really move past this protest stuff and the divisiveness of the conversation and really get to some solutions and how we can educate our fan base.
You mentioned the divisiveness, and absolutely. I was really impressed reading about, particularly what you were doing, and I've heard you refer to as a holistic approach, that you actually went and engaged with police officers as well as the community. Do the police appreciate being a part of that conversation? Because I'm sure that they want things to be better and different as well.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I know anytime you're trying to get something done, you've got to have an understanding first. And oftentimes we look at our own experiences and we speak on that and that only. And that goes on both ways. You see a lot of people that are pro-police, a lot of people that are, you know, pro-people of color or black communities, whatever. But those things aren't mutually exclusive. You can support the police and also want accountability. And so the first thing I did was engage with the police and ask them, what is it that you're going through? What are the struggles? How is it going out in these neighborhoods? What do you need? Because I know what it's like to be a black man in this country. My family knows it. The communities I serve know it. But I don't know what it's like to be an officer. And so if I want to move to a solutions, I got to be able to understand the problem from a holistic, you know, standpoint.
That's fantastic. I really think that approach is commendable. And then you also, on top of all this, you have your own foundation. And that, so the Malcolm Jenkins Foundation, yeah. And is that Philadelphia-based?
Well, we started in New Orleans in 2010 with a scholarship. Last spring, just gave over $100,000 in scholarships. That's still in place. And since 2010, we branched out to four states. Louisiana, Ohio, where I went to school at The Ohio State University, go Bucks. New Jersey, where I'm from, and then Pennsylvania, obviously, in Philadelphia.
That's great. Now, I know this already comes out. It feels like in this era, it gets asked to athletes. When the team gets invited to the White House, will you go?
No, I will not. I've been to the White House before.
Yeah.
So I don't need to see the building.
Yeah.
I won a Super Bowl, so these things are really just photo ops. And I haven't been interested in photo ops this entire time I've been involved in social activism. I'm very, very much interested in meeting with policymakers about, you know, making changes in our community. I'm definitely for that and have been doing that and engaging those activities over the last 2 years, but photo ops are really not my thing.
Well, I'm glad they're not your thing, mostly because I do find the way that you're engaging with people on both sides of the aisle and both sides of the issue, I just think it's great. And congratulations on everything. Really great having you here. Malcolm Jenkins, everyone, Super Bowl champion. For more information about his foundation and the work they're doing, please welcome. Visit the MalcolmJenkinsFoundation.org.
everyone. It's Sarah from Late Night. I'm backstage here with Malcolm Jenkins. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
New Super Bowl champion. So you talked to Seth a little bit about the Players Coalition that you and Anquan Boldin started. What has been the most sort of rewarding part of that for you in terms of things you've actually physically been able to do and people you've gotten to meet?
Well, the biggest thing has been I've been proud to be able to create a platform that allows my peers to get active, you know, because there are a lot of guys who were in my situation in 2016 that were just looking for ways to get involved. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a lot of guys engaged in a protest, but they were looking for like solutions and how to be involved with it, resources. And we've created that through the coalition of players and been able to amplify our voices. The second part of that is this, you know, initiative that we've been able to start with the NFL, where they are allowing us to direct how this goes and use their platform similar to what they've done with breast cancer awareness and Salute to Service,
right,
to raise awareness on issues like police brutality and accountability, criminal justice reform, mm-hmm, economical and educational advancement for communities of colors. Like, those type of things have never been discussed on a platform such as the NFL.
Yeah.
So I'm proud to be a part of a group of guys that have got that accomplished.
It's amazing. Following up on that, I read that because you were nominated for the Walter Payton Man of the Year Award, congratulations, by the way, they gave you two tickets to the Super Bowl, and you visited a prison, and you met a man who had been incarcerated for 30 years.
Yep.
And so you gave him the two tickets right after he was released. Can you just tell us a little bit about what that experience was like?
Yeah, so one of the things I've been talking about with criminal justice reform, especially in the state of Pennsylvania, is they're one of the few states, I think maybe only two, that still practice sending our youth to life without parole.
Yeah.
So Kempis was sentenced to life at the age of 15. And when I went to Grateford Prison to sit with some inmates and just talk about and learn about their experience, what are the challenges they face coming in,
mm-hmm,
what are the challenges that their peers are facing as they come transition out of prison, the six gentlemen I sat with were all incarcerated longer than I've been alive. Like, I'm 30 years old, just turned 30. Kempis was locked up longer than me, and so were the rest of the gentlemen. And maybe, you know, fast forward 6-7 months later, I see an article that he's got resentenced and was going to come home. So I wanted to do something special to him. I had just been recently nominated for the Man of the Year, and they told me I would get two tickets. And I just thought that was going to be a great time to be in it, to show an example that we are all better than our worst mistakes. And we can all, you know, work together to look past, you know, what we've come from and change our mindset of what people look like or as they come out of prison. Because we've got a lot of talented people. We've got a lot of guys who want to dedicate their lives to serve their communities, just like Kempis. And we just need to be able to give them that opportunity. So this is my opportunity to really be that example.
I think that's so great. And I think it's nice to shine a light on people who really, like, he was pursuing an undergraduate degree in college and working on other programs. You know, I think there is this mindset of that when you go to prison, that you deserve to be there and that, you know, you got what you deserve. But there are a lot of other people in there who, like you said, have been sentenced for a long period of time when they're kids. And one mistake then is your whole life.
Yeah, I think we have to, if we want to move forward as a country, especially when it comes to addressing our criminal justice system and the fact that we incarcerate 25% of, you know, we hold 25% of prison population in the world. If we want to address that, we have to understand that, you know, people are better than what we paint them as. We can't have this tough on crime mentality, and that there are more people affected than we actually believe. One in three people over the age of 18 has some kind of arrest or criminal record. That's a huge portion of the population that is affected. And especially when we're talking about our youth, we have to believe in the human capacity to change and grow. And I thought this was an opportunity to really highlight that.
Yeah. And you've done such amazing work in Philadelphia and other areas through your foundation. So the fans have obviously responded. There's a parade happening. It's Thursday?
Yes, parade? Thursday.
So what are you anticipating in terms of what you think, how the city's going to turn out?
I hope the city survives. That is all I can hope for, is that there is a city left. Man, this Philadelphia has been waiting so long for this to happen. Since the Super Bowl has been in existence, this city hadn't been able to taste that victory. And they've come close, have had some great teams, some legendary players, but hadn't had this feeling. And so for me to be a part of the team that has brought this to the city, as invested as I've been in the community and how much I love Philly, man, I couldn't ask for anything more. I think every player and coach and member of the team is ready to get to this parade because it's going to be like no other.
Yeah. Well, you'll probably have to, you know, phone in and give us an update tomorrow or Friday on how it goes.
No doubt. Okay. If I'm sober
if
enough
everyone
to
survives. Yeah. Okay. Thanks so much for being here. It was really nice to meet you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Guest tonight from his work on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. He stars in the new comedy series AP Bio. You can catch a special preview Thursday night at 9:30 here on NBC. Please welcome to the show Glenn Howerton, everyone. Welcome to the show.
I'm wearing a suit.
You're wearing a suit. You look very dapper.
Thank you.
But I want to ask about this because you did a very non-suit activity recently. You went to a survival, what is it called? Survival training camp?
Yes. Okay. We did not wear suits.
Yeah, I would imagine.
You're right. It was a wilderness survival retreat.
Okay. A weekend? 2 days? A day?
It was a 3-day course where me and my friends learned how to survive in the wilderness without the things that you normally have on hand.
What brought this about as something you wanted to do?
Living in California, I realized I live very near where a lot of earthquakes could happen. There could be a big earthquake. The house could fall down. Lots of things. I guess I was dipping my toes into doomsday prepping.
Okay, I gotcha.
A little bit, if you will.
Just little toe dip.
Yeah,
and
just dipping
my toes. After the 3 days, do you feel better about your family's chances?
No.
Okay.
I'm now actually wilderness first aid certified.
Oh, that's pretty
that's
good.
That's true.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people don't know this, but to be wilderness first aid certified, you're not actually really supposed to treat the person. You're just supposed to keep them alive.
Okay.
Until somebody who actually knows something shows up. So a lot of it's really just like, hey, I'm here. I'm here. I'm here for you. You know
like,
what I mean?
Stay with me, that kind of thing?
Stay with me and slapping them.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah.
Don't you leave me.
Yeah, don't you die on me,
don't
you son
you
of
die.
A bitch.
Oh, that's a good one. You son of a bitch, right.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Until the chopper shows up, and then you're like, I'm out of here.
Wow.
I guess I just felt like I wanted to make sure that I knew how to do basic things that we got so comfortable in society. You know, we have running water, and I didn't realize, you know, I ask a lot of people, like, what's the first thing that'll kill you if you're lost in the wilderness and you're injured? And most people say, well, you'll run out of water. So you'd be very, very thirsty, and you'll die of whatever that's called, when you die of not having enough water. And it's actually exposure.
Just to
the elements.
To the elements.
Yeah, so if you sleep on the ground and, you know, it's warm outside, if it gets cold at night, you'll die because the ground will freeze you to death. So you got to build a thing and put put leaves in there.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And so but you'll die later of Lyme disease because there are ticks in the leaves.
But you'll buy yourself a couple days.
You'll buy yourself a couple days. And then a life of misery suffering from Lyme disease. But, yeah, in the meantime,
I think you and I are very similar. Because, well, very congratulations. Always Sunny, 12 seasons, which is, no one does that. I've also been working in TV for a while now. And do you think that you now officially, because I feel this way, I officially don't know how to do anything of value. Like, of real life value.
Oh, I see. Yeah, you get comfortable, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Well, were you ever handy? Were you ever somebody who could fix something in your house?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, okay. Like I had to cut the grass, I had to trim the hedges, and I had to fix stuff around the house. But my dad didn't teach me a ton of stuff. You know, even though he kind of knew how to do that stuff, I think he wanted to shelter us from it and not make us have to do that. I had to learn, when I was in theater school, I had to learn stagecraft. So I learned how to use some tools. And I would fix things in the house when they got broken. You get comfortable. After a while, you realize, I don't want to do that. I'm going to hire somebody to do it.
Yeah. The most depressing thing in my life is my wife's dad is, a builder. And her brother knows everything. And so when something breaks in our house, it's really emasculating because one of them shows up with a tool belt and is like, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, let me put down this Xbox controller and pretend to see what you're seeing.
Yeah. I can tell you how to fix chapped lips.
Yeah.
But
everybody says that about you.
but I can't teach you how to fix a, you know, a light switch or something. I don't even, it's sad. You sort of forget to, I mean, you can, I think to a certain degree we all suffer from this, but if you start to make a little bit of dough, you start to realize, oh, I'll pay a guy to do that. I'll pay a guy to do this. And I'm worried that I'm not going to teach my kids because I have two boys.
Yeah.
You know, and I, like I said, I used to cut the grass and all that. And I'm like, I don't want them cutting my grass because I don't want them messing up my grass. You know, whereas like my dad was like, you're cutting the grass.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like,
I also just worry about how my dad knows a lot about everything.
Yeah.
Like, and now I just feel like because of the internet, anything my kid asks me, I'll be like, let's go over to the laptop.
Yeah, the box of knowledge.
Yeah.
Let's go to the box of knowledge.
This is where daddy put all his ideas.
Yeah, and take credit for it.
Yeah, now we can go find them.
I built this box of knowledge for you, son, so that when I pass on, it's like Superman and his dad. He's like the crystal thing.
Right. So this show, AP Bio, full disclosure, because I love this show, but I'm one of the producers on this show. And I'm so happy that you are playing this role. You are playing a teacher who, we sort of set it up in the clip, but you are not a good person. Would you say that's accurate on the show?
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty accurate.
Yeah.
Or at least I'm trying not to be a good person.
Yeah.
I think the secret sauce to the show is that he is extremely selfish and narcissistic, but ultimately, and I think the creator, Mike O'Brien, has done
yes,
such
a
great
fantastic
job.
Writer.
He's amazing. He was on SNL for 6 years as a writer. And he's created a character who puts on this front of being extremely selfish and narcissistic. But I think under it all, there is some heart there. But yeah, he basically goes into class and says, I'm not going to teach you anything. You know, this is a free period for you.
Yeah.
And if you do what I tell you to do and don't try to make me teach you biology, then I'm going to give you all an A. Which I think is, to most classes, that would be like a sweet deal. But these kids, and this is part of what makes the show so different, is these kids actually want to learn something, and that's a problem for me.
Yeah.
I don't want to have to do
work. You offer them Advil or Tylenol PM. You actually give them a chance to just take a pill and fall asleep for an hour.
Yeah. Yeah. It's basically what you would want your teachers to do when you were in school, but not these kids.
Did you have important teachers in your life? Were you someone who...
Important teachers?
Oh, yeah, that sent you on your path. I mean, you ended up going to Juilliard.
I did.
So obviously something happened in high school that made you think, oh, I should be an actor.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I had any. I didn't have any, like, lean on me type teachers,
uh-huh.
You know, any stand by me's.
You didn't have a lean on me or a stand by me?
Stand by me. I had no one by me,
yeah.
Basically. No, I didn't have any teachers who, like, turned my life around or anything like that. But, I tell you, There was this one teacher that I loved, and he was my health teacher. I think his name was Coach Scott, because he was also the football coach.
Uh-huh, yeah.
The health teacher is never just the health teacher. He's always something else.
I think my health teacher was also our football coach, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I don't get that, really. I think he was, like, the offensive line coach, but also the health teacher. Because, I mean, who better to teach you about, you know, your budding human sexuality than an obese high school Alabama football coach? No, he's the one you want teaching you about your body and all the feelings you're feeling.
I feel like back in the day, health teacher was a different thing. It was based. It was like, who knows how to do squats?
Oh,
and
yeah.
then it became more about, like, sex ed, and there it took a while for people to adjust as to who should be the better teacher there.
Yeah, and it seems like that's based on where you are in the country, right? Because in Alabama, it's like, we have to talk about sex, but we really don't want to talk about sex, but we should, but we can't, and
yeah.
We will. You know, so listening to this man try to explain the secondary sex characteristics of a female was very uncomfortable.
So, but you had a very interesting upbringing. Your dad was in the Air Force. So you traveled all around the world.
Yeah.
And then ended up at high school in Alabama. What was, by the time you got to high school, like, was your international experience, did that make you ready for an American high school or not ready for an American high school?
I would say not ready.
Okay.
I mean, because most of the schools I'd gone to were military schools. So other kids were always coming in and everybody was like, hey, and welcoming each other. But when I moved to Alabama, everybody had been there and grown up together. So, you know, I just felt like a real dork. I was like, hey, nice to meet everybody. And everyone's like, no, who are you? Like, get out of here, you know?
Did you at least, like, was it true you were in Korea for a while?
Yeah.
So did you at least know what American pop culture was or American style?
We had, like, one American station on the TV. So I knew Jeopardy. and cartoons. But no, I mean, my parents were, first of all, they're not, I love them. They're such wonderful, wonderful people, but they weren't like hip. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? So like they were going to, and my mom's so cheap. So we would go to this this Korean market called Itaewon, and she would buy us like the cheapest knockoff, like members only, you know, and the Velcro sneakers. And basically when I showed up to school in Alabama, everyone had like their, whatever was cool in Alabama, their polo shirts. And I had like a guy on a horse, but it wasn't. Right. It wasn't the right guy. He wasn't playing polo. He wasn't, I don't know what he was doing. He was playing a different sport.
It was a weird horse.
It was a weird horse. They didn't have four legs. It had like three legs because they, you know, they could because of copyright things. So yeah, I was wearing clothes from like a different decade. It was bad.
That's
was
fantastic. Bad. I'm glad everything worked out for you, and you found a place where you're comfortable and happy. The woods, where you
in
can
woods.
Survive in the woods.
That's right.
Thanks so much for being here. I'm so excited for the show. And I'm so happy to be working with you, Glenn Howard, and everybody. Check out a special preview, AP Bio, Thursday night at 9:30 here on NBC.
Hey, this is Kevin from Late Night. We are backstage with Glenn Howerton. Glenn, thanks for taking a couple questions backstage.
It is my utter pleasure.
So how did you initially get involved with AP Bio?
Well, I was sent the script, but I also, you know, was made aware of the pedigree behind it. So I knew that Lauren was involved. I knew that Seth was involved. And I was familiar with Mike from SNL. So there was much more behind it than just that. But honestly, the script itself would have probably done the job for me. But it was important to me to know that the people behind it were going to preserve the integrity of the show so that it wouldn't turn into something, you know, that wasn't what was on the page, because what was on the page was so funny.
Having run your own show and gone 12 seasons with It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, is it nice to relinquish a little of the control of not running the show, of starring in it, but also being a producer, but letting someone else write the show and sort of do the heavy lifting?
Yeah, it was great. But I knew I could only do that with people that I trusted, which is why it was important to know the team behind it. It was a huge relief, because it's obviously far less work to have to, you know, show up and produce and write and act in the shows. It's a lot of work. It's exhausting. So it was nice to be able to kind of go back to my roots of just being an actor, working with some really great material and know that I was taken care of on the other side.
You've got a great story about a show that you were in, that 80s show, one of the first times you met Charlie. If you can tell that story about the audition.
Yeah, well, my first big break, really, as an actor, certainly in Hollywood, was I did that 80s show, which was supposed to be the big follow-up to that 70s show. I knew that they were very interested in me because they'd seen an audition that I had for some other show, and they called me out to test for the show, which is where you kind of do the final auditions for a show in LA, where you test, they call it testing. So you test for the studio and you test for the network. So I went to test, and I felt like it really well. Testing with me were a couple of actors. One of them was Charlie Day. Charlie Day was testing to play my character's best friend. And so we did a couple scenes together, and, you know, that was it. And as we were leaving the audition, I said, you know, I'd seen Charlie at auditions in New York and stuff like that. So we were chatting a little bit, and I was like, "Where are you going, man?" And he's like, "Well, I'm gonna catch a cab back to my hotel." But I was like, I got a rental car. You wanna come with me?" And he goes, "Oh, you got a rental car?" I was like, "Yeah, they got me a rental car." He's like, "They got you a rental car?" They didn't get me a rental car. So, you know, right off the bat, I think Charlie got the impression that he was not as important to them as I was, which was, you know. So we were riding in the car, and my phone rings. It's my agent. I'm like, "Oh, my God, this could be the call. This is amazing." Not thinking of Charlie at all. I answer the phone. It's my agent, Stephanie Ritz. She's like, "You got the job. They hired you. You got it. You're going to be the lead on a Fox sitcom." It was like and I was like, "Oh, my God, this is incredible. This is awesome," and I was like, "Well, I'm actually sitting here with I'm in the car with Charlie Day. Do you know what's going on with Charlie?" And she was like, there was like a pause, and then she was like, "Yeah, put me on the phone with Charlie." So I hand the phone to Charlie, and I just hear Charlie going, "Yeah, uh-huh, okay, well, you know, yeah, yeah, all right, well, you know, what are you gonna do? You know, what are you gonna do?"
That's great.
And right there, I was like, why did I do that? Yeah. Why did I put Charlie in that position?
Yeah.
Anyway, that was really the first time I'd ever really met Charlie Day. But we didn't really become friends until a couple years after.
Well, luckily, it all worked out, and you guys have gone on to do incredible work on Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And AP Bio is so good, and I'm really excited to watch more episodes.
I'm excited for everyone to check the show out. Yeah, for sure.
Thanks again, and come back again soon.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, Glenn.
Thank you.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.